So it's a pleasure to be here in, at this conference in Santa Barbara, and I would like today to present a work done in collaboration with Tanuj Rezadas-Gupta and Claudius Gross on the spin singlet nature of various dimerized cuprates from ab initio calculations to experimental results. So I have organized this talk as follows. First, I would like to say some words on our motivation to study certain quantum spin systems, and especially I will discuss the dimerized cuprates and why are they interesting. I will then present some results on the microscopic description of two examples of dimerized cuprates. These are the calcium copper germanate. This is a system which is related to the spin piles copper germanate and the family of potassium and thallium copper chlorides. These are systems that they have been recently studied with inelastic neutron scattering. Our microscopic description is based on a combination of ab initio and quantum Monte Carlo calculations. And finally, I will present my summary and conclusions. So coming to my motivation, there is a large class of low-dimensional transitional metal compounds, like some cuprates, vanadates, tellurates, which show very interesting properties, some of them directly related to this low dimensionality. For instance, we have here copper germanate. This is a system which consists basically on copper chains that run along the C-axis. And in this copper chain, not only the nearest neighbor copper-copper interaction is important, but also the next nearest neighbor copper-copper interaction, what means that these chains are frustrated J1, J2 chains. When we lower the temperature on the system, the system undergoes a phase transition, which is a spin piles phase transition, in which a spin gap opens in the excitation spectrum. Another interesting beispiel is sodium vanadate, which was yesterday discussed by Sascha Lichtenstein. This system, it's a mixed valence system. That means that the vanadiums have an average oxidation of 4.5+. And when the temperature is lowered in the system, what happens is that there is a spin piles phase transition together with a charge ordering into vanadium spin 1/2 and vanadium spin 0. And another example that I wanted to show is the recently synthesized copper tellurate. This is a system that consists of copper frustrated copper tetrahedra, which are weakly interacting among them. And this system orders at very low temperatures, but the nature of this ordering is not yet completely understood. So in fact, there is a lot of discussion whether the system has almost quantum critical behavior. So we see that all these low dimensional materials show a rich variety of effects. Some of them are competing. And if we want to understand the microscopic origin of these effects, we need to take into account the electron correlation. These are strong electron correlated systems. So the way we proceed to study these systems is, first of all, by making an ab initio analysis with a density functional theory, so we can calculate the electronic structure from the crystal structure. And we know that in the LDA, or the GGA approximation, the Coulomb repulsion is not correctly taken into account. So what the way we consider that is by building up effective models in where the Hopping parameters are downfolded from the electronic structure, and then we consider the electron correlation in terms of U or V terms. So we end up with effective models which are Hubbard-like, Heisenberg-like, DJ-like. Once we have this low energy effective model, then we can calculate such properties as thermodynamics properties, like susceptibility, magnetization, specific heat, by using various techniques like DMRG or quantum Monte Carlo, and we can compare it directly to experiments. So we get a physical picture of our systems. The systems I want to present today from all this class of low-dimensional materials are the dimerized cuprates. These systems are quantum spin systems with a singlet triplet gap in the spin excitation spectrum, and they are interesting because under application of an external magnetic field, one can close this gap, and then the system can undergo different kinds of phase transition as a function of the magnetic field and the temperature, which depend on the topology of the exchange interactions and also on the dimension of the system. So the system show a very rich physics. But often, what happens is that the true nature of the change networks that we need to know in order to understand these phase transitions are not the ones that are expected by just looking at the crystal structure of these materials. So a microscopic investigation is important in order to understand which are the important interactions. And I will show you here two examples in where just looking at the crystal structure, one would, in fact, consider a very different model from what the, really the system, from really the system, from the way the system really behaves. So let me start by calcium copper germanate. This is a system which has a monoclinic structure and consists of Jan Teller distorted copper O6. Octahedra, well, here it's difficult to say, but this octahedra basically build zigzag chains. And these zigzag chains are separated from each other by calcium and germanium. So in fact, to see this picture a little bit better, I have here only kept the coppers, which are in a, and what we see is basically the system shows a structure of zigzag copper chains which alternate between two neighbor BC planes. So basically we have, this is one copper chain, the next copper chain is just one half the unit cell, so by C one half, and here is the next copper chain. So by just looking at this structure, one would expect that this system, it's a quasi one-dimensional system described by these chains here. So one would expect possibly Heisenberg-like behavior. Now if we look at the susceptibility and magnetization experiments, this doesn't seem to be the behavior of this system. So here we have the susceptibility. These are measurements done by Sasago and co-authors. And what we see is that the system shows here a broad maximum. That is what one expects for a low-dimensional anti-ferromagnetic spin system. But then we have a fast drop of the susceptibility at, so at 40K, a fast drop to zero, what means that this system has a spin gap. So there is the ground state of this singlet, it's in fact a spin singlet ground state with an energy gap. This interpretation can be corroborated by these magnetization measurements with high magnetic fields, where one observes that above 30 Tesla, there is raise of the magnetization indicating that the system has an energy gap. Also, Andres Tseludev has done some inelastic neutron scattery measurements on powder samples, and he finds an energy gap of about 6 milli electron volts. What is important is that this spin gap that one observes here in these measurements is not originated by a spin pile phase transition. We see no indication of such a transition in these measurements. So it's something that it should be intrinsic in the system. And now the question we pose is then, which is the microscopic model for the system? Where are, or which are, the copper pairs that constitute these antiferromagnetic dimers, so this singlet ground state? And for that, what we first consider is the band structure for this material. And here I show the band structure. We have considered the LAPW and also compared with LMTO results. And basically what we have to see here is that there are four narrow bands near the Fermi level, which are mainly of copper D x squared minus y squared character. And what we do now is basically we do downfolding in order to obtain the Hopping parameters. Also, we can do, we have done also a variational tight binding fit, and both methods agree quite well. And what we obtain is the following. The important Hopping term is the one which corresponds to third nearest neighbors coppers. So that means that it's telling us that this is the important Hopping in this system. And it is, in fact, the one that will build these dimers, these copper dimers. And the next important Hopping term is the first nearest neighbors, which is the one here in this zigzag chain. And in contrast, the second and the fourth nearest neighbors just play a very small role in this material. So this analysis already is telling us that the important interaction in these systems will be the third nearest neighbors and the first nearest neighbors. In fact, we can see by just analyzing the electron density that these third nearest neighbors, basically the Hopping term is enhanced. Here, the picture is a little bit, it's not very good, but basically what I want to show, this is the third nearest neighbor coppers. These are the different oxygens, and these are four nearest neighbors coppers. And what we see is that the paths through these oxygens are contributing to this Hopping term, while this Hopping term here is quite disconnected. Now, with this electronic band analysis, we have sort of pinpoint which are the important interactions in these systems, namely the third nearest neighbors interaction and the first nearest neighbors interaction. We can, of course, try to get an estimate of which would be the corresponding J for these dimers, and we get it's of order 7 MeV. But what we want to do, in fact, is really go to an effective model. And our effective model, just by considering these results, will be that of a system of interacting dimers with third nearest neighbors interactions and first nearest neighbors interactions. And this is the lattice that we have, where we have these are the third nearest neighbor interactions and these are the first nearest neighbors interactions. And now with this spin model, we can calculate the thermodynamic properties by considering quantum Monte Carlo with the stochastic series expansions. So we have calculated the susceptibility and the magnetization with this model and compared with experiments. And what we see is the following. What we see is that for a value of J3, which is of 67K, well, 5.8 MeV, and for a quotient of J1 over J3 minus 0.2, we can reproduce the susceptibility results, and also we reproduce the magnetization in this material. So what we see is that the sign is negative, what is telling us that J1, it's a weak ferromagnetic interdimer coupling. So we see that by combining ab initio and these calculations of susceptibility and magnetization, we can really see which are the important interactions in this material. And we can explain also the experiments. There is an interesting aspect of this model, and is the following. If we look at this model, we have two extreme cases. One would be the case that J3 is equal to zero. That means we will have independent ferro or antiferromagnetic chains. So this is a system of independent chains, so it's a gapless system. Or we have the other extreme, when J1 is equal to zero, we only have J3, we have then non-interacting dimers, so the system is gapful. So there must be a critical ratio of J1 over J3, where the system goes from a gapful phase to a gapless phase. So we must have here some quantum critical point. And we have looked for those quantum critical points, and those are the two. One is at J1 about 0.55 J3, and the other one is J1 over about minus 0.9 J3. And we see that, unfortunately, this material is away, is far away from this quantum criticality. So what we then learned from the system is, just summarizing this material, is that ab initio and the examination of susceptibility and magnetization by quantum Monte Carlo provides us an ambiguous picture of the system as the system of dimers formed by three nearest neighbors, spin 1/2 couplers, with ferromagnetic first nearest neighbors into dimer couplings. If we now want to sort of compare the J's obtained from ab initio and the J's obtained from quantum Monte Carlo, we see that qualitatively there is a good agreement. But we know that these J's from ab initio are very much dependent on the U that one considers. What we considered here was the U that we know for copper germanate. And important, also an important property is that this system, it shows no spin bias transition. Now, if we compare with the other member of the same family, this behavior is certainly different, because copper germanate is, first of all, frustrated system and has a spin piles phase transition. Now, I would like to show in the 5 minutes?
Yeah,
7 minutes, okay. That's fine. 7 minutes is fine. I would like just to show another example of these dimerized cuprates. And this is the case of potassium and thallium copper chlorides. These are systems which are isostructural. They are also crystallizing in this monoclinic space group. And here I can show you the crystal structure. It's very similar to the previous material. So again, we have these zigzag ladders of coppers, or if you want, zigzag chains, or if you want, you can view that as ladders of coppers, which are basically running along the z-axis, and they alternate between different planes. And they are separated by this thallium or potassium ions. So the structure is very similar to the case of calcium copper germanate. Now, for these materials, there are very good crystals. And the group in Zurich and the group in Tokyo have done inelastic neutron scattering experiments, and they find the following results. So for thallium copper chloride, this is a strongly coupled spin dimer system. This they find, actually, of course, by analyzing the magnet dispersion. And the spin excitation gap is of about 0.65 MeV. Now they apply an external magnetic field, and so strong enough that they can close the gap, and then they observe nil ordering. And they have also interpreted what they observe as a Bose-Einstein condensation of magnons. In the case of potassium copper chloride, this system has a spin excitation gap which is almost 4 times bigger as the case of the thallium copper chloride. Contrary to this compound, the system seems to be weakly a coupled dimer system, and of course a nil ordering is also observed when one goes up to 22 tesla, magnetic fields of 22 tesla. Now here what we are interested in, what we want to understand is what really determines the difference between these two systems. So this system has a spin gap which is almost 4 times bigger than this one, and it seems to show a weakly coupled dimer behavior, while this one is a strongly coupled dimer behavior. So we can think of two possibilities. One is structural differences. With that, I mean the following. This thallium, the unit cell of thallium copper chloride, it's someone compressed in the A direction and enlarged in the BC direction with respect to the potassium copper chloride. That means that some distances between the atoms and some angles will be different between both systems. And of course, we also have the question of the role of thallium and potassium in the interactions for the systems. So we can already, at the level of the Van structure, understand what's going on in the systems, or at least answer some of these questions. And here are the Van structure calculations. This is for potassium copper chloride, and this is for thallium copper chloride. Basically, this Van structure consists of four bands of copper dx squared minus y squared mixed with chlor p states. And already we see here, by comparing the band structures for the two systems, is that the thallium compound shows a more dispersive band than the calcium copper chloride at the Fermi surface. That, translated in the language of Hopping matrix elements, will of course give us a stronger Hopping matrix elements for this system than for this system. But what we want to now understand here is what really is defining the difference between two systems. So what we do is, first we consider the potassium copper chloride, but in the lattice of the thallium copper chloride. So we make just the calculation by keeping potassium, but putting it into the crystal structure of thallium copper chloride. And we see that there's almost no difference in the band structure. So the change of lattice parameters has a minor effect on the band structure. But if we consider potassium copper chloride and we change potassium by thallium, we get that there is really significant differences between the two band structures. So that it's telling us that the substitution potassium by thallium is really, from the two possibilities, the one that will give the differences between these two systems. So we have also then analyzed the Hopping matrix elements, and what we find is that the important Hopping matrix elements in this system are, first of all, the nearest neighbor copper-copper that defines our dimers, but the next important coupling, it's the one which is between two next nearest neighbors ladders. So it's not anymore in one ladder, but in the next nearest neighbor ladders. And this is in agreement with the results from inelastic neutron scattering data. And also we see that the Hopping matrix elements for thallium are bigger than for the potassium compound. So what we conclude with this analysis is that we can pin down what is really defining the differences between the behavior of these two systems, and this is the evident role of thallium in this exchange copper-copper pathways. So with that, I think I've exhausted my time. No? Fine, then I can just comment my conclusions. And my conclusions are the following, is that by considering a combination of ab initio and many-body techniques, one can really understand the microscopic behavior of low-dimensional systems. In this case, I have shown the case of calcium copper germanate. And what's interesting is that what we learn also from this investigation is that the system has long-range dominated exchange couplings with ferromagnetic interdimer couplings. So this is not obvious by just looking at the crystal structure. And we have, in fact, other examples where that is also the case, like calcium vanadate or the Vopo compound. in this case, that's an alternating chain, and important vanadium-vanadium interactions are given by paths through two phosphor-O4 tetrahedra. So this is, again, only there are inelastic neutron scattering data and ab initio results that can really pinpoint this interaction. And finally, just the comment that by doing, in this case, only band structure calculations, we could, first of all, corroborate the behavior predicted by inelastic neutron scattering data, and also that the differences in the interdimer coupling, we see that they are related to this thallium and not to the different structure of the two systems. So thank you very much for your attention.
Brilliant timing of this talk leaves us 5 minutes for questions. So if there are comments or questions, please. Yes, Sasha.
Hello. Why do you use simple T square over U to estimate the J? First question, why you only use two J's?
Okay, the first question is, I only wanted to say, okay, just look, in principle one can do this 4T over square over U, but one cannot really believe this result. That's why we don't like to get the J's in this way, but what we do is then we compare with measurements, and then we can really get good J's. Just that I wanted to show that in this case, the hopping, the values of the hoppings and doing this 4T square over U, one can get reasonable good J's. But it's not really the general the general rule. One, we know that this is not a good way of usually getting the J's. I mean, one has to, first of all, one has to pay attention that if you are really describing a superexchange kind of a path, which is not always the case, and it's very much dependent on the use that you are considering. So I just wanted to say, okay, look here, the T's are in the range that that we also get if we were to consider J's in this way. And not the other question,
no,
yeah.
No, but yeah, it was like Matthias Troyer with Anisimov, so they just argue that probably exchange is more longer range,
yeah.
Which is very hard to guess from experiment.
Exactly. That's why it was important here to do this ab initio, because we were faced with these experiments and we didn't know, in fact, which were the important interactions, and the ab initio really hits you which are the important ones.
There was a question in the back.
Yeah,
I mean, my question was somewhat similar. Let me put it add a little bit to that. You start with an LATW calculation, you said, and then by don't coding, you arrive to your T parameters and so on.
Yeah.
Can you just explain a little bit actually how you do this don't coding?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And actually, how much does this depend really on the change correlation function and also on the lattice function? Because you get three digits usually with your.
Sorry, you? Yes, yeah, this I thought afterwards when I had the transparencies done, I should have given the errors. I haven't given them here. But to the first question, here we do two types of calculations, LAPW and LMTO. Now, the downfolding is done on the LMTO bands. The reason why we also do LAPW is because LAPW is more accurate than LMTO, and then we just really compare the two until both reach the good accuracy. We have then also done the tight binding on the LAPW and compare the results with the downfolded LMTO, and they compare very well. So at least
how
for
many
this,
how many digits?
Right, with exactly. So with two digits, it's a good. It's a good. But of course, we really had to work hard because you are downfolding LMTO and you are doing tight binding on a LAPW. And this is not the rule. I mean, there are many cases where you really get more differences than that. So only one digit is good. I mean, it's not the rule.
Well, I think only the first digit is good, if I would also say I don't really know the difference.
But yeah, no.
It could be the LDA or could be the correct.
Yeah, there is another point that I didn't say. When one does downfolding, one gets in theory, infinite t's, because you do a Fourier transform of this renormalized band. That means that you have, in principle, your contribution is distributed into these t's. Usually you have the nearest neighbors, t's are the stronger ones, and then it decays. When you do tight binding, you are doing a variational fit with only a finite number of t's. That's why you don't expect that this finite number of t's will be really accurately like the downfolding, but because here you already include these longer range t's that were in downfolding and are not here in the tight binding. So this is something also that one has to take into account. And the other question was for, that you say was about the experimental.
Basically, the error bar, because, for example, the uncertainty of the lattice constant.
Right. Exactly. Well, here there is another point. You can, with LAPW, find the minimum of the structure. So you give the lattice constants obtained from experiments, but then you do a minimization to find really which lattice constants give you the minimum in energy. We didn't do that in this case. The lattice constants were given by various groups that have done X-ray, and they are quite good up to the fourth digit, so they are really very good determined. That's why we didn't do this calculation here.
So you use experimental.
Yes. We didn't do the minimization.
Right, one question in the back here. Are you still interested?
Yes, well, just continuing this discussion. I mean, is it too difficult to do frozen in or constrained speed polarizations and then deduce J's?
Yeah, one can do that, yeah. Not definitely.
And then some of these ambiguities would disappear.
Yeah, it's definitely. One can, of course, the spin polarize. One can work more on the ab initio side. Okay. It's only that what we wanted is basically to come to our minimal model, to then be able to reproduce susceptibility and magnetization. So we were not so much interested in the quantitative values of the J's obtained from ab initio.
No, J's will be much, much higher in LDA than
usually. Usually. Yeah, this is also what we see, that usually you get, by doing this kind of, if you do continuing ab initio, you get a bigger J's than what you obtain by comparing with experiments.
So Carson and then George, and then maybe we'll break for lunch. We'll continue this discussion as between LDA fall on the ab initio side to LDA plus U kinds of calculation and maybe getting a J's.
One can do that, and my collaborator Tanus does some of this LDA plus U. I mean, I also do that in LAPW, and you can of course get very much better J's than the one that I was just giving here. It's just that I tend to believe, at least at this level, that the J's that I will get by comparing various experiments are going to be much better than the ones I'm going to get from ab initio. It's just that I had this point of view. That's why I didn't show.
I was wondering the bands that you got between the copper bands and the rest, when you substituted potassium with
Halley, are those Halley derived bands?
No, I'm sorry, I said no. I will show you just a second, if I just find them. So, where did I leave the bands? Here. Good. So, the bands here at the Fermi surface, these are copper bands.
But the bands just below.
The bands just below, of course, we have the thallium S, the chlor piece, and also for the potassium S. So these are the bands. As you see, they are quite far away from the ones on the Fermi surface. So in principle, they are not
in the case of potassium, but not in the case of thallium.
Yeah, not in the case of potassium.
I'm wondering whether the bands are close to the copper band.
Yeah.
They are mainly thallium bands.
Yeah.
Thallium
bands. Yeah. Exactly. From
that's
here.
Surely not unexpected that you would have a large component to the...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're maybe ready to clap all our speakers.